Good afternoon. So what we decided is that I was going to do the background and then everyone else can share their data. Anyway, I know that we're all sort of working among similar populations here. I have nothing to disclose. So basically, I'm giving you a portion of some of the research I did in the last couple years on my dissertation, which is now becoming an international cross-cultural cross-comparison study. But we're going to talk about children with special needs in my study today who are from actually Chicago, Cook County. So as we probably know, who are children with special needs, 15.1% in our country, and you can see the health insurance division, which I think is one of the most interesting parts of what's going on with children is how they're insured. And it's reported now that 34% report being underinsured, so that means that their current insurance is inadequate to pay for all of their necessary healthcare needs. That's from the National Survey of Children with Special Needs, the CSHCN data. So a little background. So I'm really interested in accessibility and continuity of care. And one of the things I've thought about in access, so people kind of say a lot, okay, well, they do have access, they don't have access, and what does that mean? So we know that children with special needs have a higher level of unmet needs. They're more likely to be poor, near poor. They're more likely to be uninsured or underinsured, like this 30%. They're more likely to be have low SES, low education, employment, literacy, and cultural issues. And I don't know if any of you have ever worked in the care coordination program for children with special needs, a state one. I have. And I know that when you have a caseload of like 120, you get very, very little help with care coordination and getting access to care. So children with special needs, are more likely to have increased difficulties navigating the healthcare system, with repeated attempts to find services and failures to find services. And that's kind of a well-known idea that families are left to fend for themselves. Bernice Pascoe-Solito calls it muddling through, kind of trying to get through, and how it goes, you kind of go in and you go out, you have access to a service, you go through to that service, maybe you finish that treatment, but then suddenly again, you have another issue that comes up, you have to get access again, and it's kind of a muddling through, it's not kind of a straight shot that you get access and then everything is good. And this is the process of how parents get access to care is something that I'm really interested in. And I think it's sort of the link of how we think about some of the outcomes in access and quality and continuity of care. So my general research question was looking at how social networks function to influence healthcare decision making and facilitate or compromise access to healthcare for children with special needs. And particularly in today, I want to talk about the idea of how do families understand the idea of access? Okay, what does access mean to families? And is it the same as how other people conceive it? So we know from many quantitative studies that it's sort of whether you get a service, whether you receive a service, or whether you perceive that you can get a service. On a lot of quantitative studies, that's usually how it's measured. It's kind of a yes-no dichotomous variable. So there are kind of two models that we look through. So the Anderson in a Day behavioral model looks at potential or realized access, whether you actually have it or whether you think that you have it, and so that's also considered access. And then, as I talked about before, this modeling through is Pesco-Solito's network episode model. And so what I did was try to use some of these theoretical concepts to think about how people conceive access, and then once we understand how people view this idea of access, then we could figure out, like, what is going on. So this was a qualitative study. I used a non-probabilistic purposive sampling technique of a larger quantitative study where I did 30 in-person qualitative interviews, 60 to 90 minutes. In these interviews, they were somewhat structured. So in the beginning, it was more of a tell me the story of your child. And these were all children within the definition. So that would be behavioral, mm-hmm. cognitive, physical, and emotional disabilities within, so this grand concept of children with special needs. So mostly parents, sometimes other aunts, grandmothers, would tell me about sort of the story of their child. And then we did this this hierarchical mapping technique, which is right here, which we talked about who are the people in your social network that help you get access to services. And then we put them in this map. So I sat with them and we talked about who are the most important people that help you. And they would go kind of in the middle circle. And then we talked about how they would help, different types of support they would provide. So instrumental, you know, day-to-day support, coming over, babysitting, bringing food, doing all kinds of things, informational, maybe giving a resource, financial giving funding or helping with access to funding, and emotional sort of support. And then there's also this idea of negative support, that you can have people that are supporting you every day in, like, the biggest ways, but also it has consequences that, let's say, you can have a mother or a grandparent that is giving you a lot of support, but they're also very anxious about the whole thing, and it's a struggle. You want their support, but it's also a lot to maintain all of their anxiety about the situation, let's say. Or in my sample, there were a bunch of unfortunate dads who kind of were out of the picture, and they gave financial support, but it was very negative. And another group of negative people were extended family who had trouble dealing with the family. But they still kind of tried to give support from a distance. I'm just going back. So anyway, we went through this narrative, and then we talked about all these people and their social support network. And then I coded them and uses all kinds of qualitative methods to figure out what was going on with these interviews. And so this quota sampling, I don't know if anyone knows about quota sampling, purposive quota sampling. So you, in order to get people from a larger mix of kind of variables, so you try to get, if I only had three, I had 30 cases that I was going to interview, and I made sure that each case qualified for some of the different variables, let's say ethnicity, so I wanted to see the minimum number of cases required, and I made sure that each case qualified for some of those variables so that in the whole sample, you can see that there is a variety of people, income, geographical area, race, ethnicity, education, and so on, and health insurance. So it's sort of a cool way to do a sample. It's a lot of work to do, but it's fun. Okay, so what did I find? So one of the things, how people described access to care. So it was more of people described process-oriented conceptualization of healthcare access, not a yes or no. Okay, it's a process. Second, it was sort of a continuum of choice by two endpoints that represent two ideal types, this sort of limited choice. People have limited choice, or they have open choice. And so basically half and half. I'm going to skip this one. So I'm going to give you some examples of how parents conceptualize these ideas. So limited choice was... here's a mom, a caregiver of a dually insured 14-year-old white girl with von Willebrand's disease, which is a bleeding disorder. And I asked her about how she got the hematologist that she for her daughter, and I said, "Well, is this particular doctor just one from the practice?" Correct. It wasn't somebody that you picked, I asked her. No, he was just one that had an opening and was able to get in. And for many families, they call, and whoever has an opening, that's who you get, okay? And that happens for many of us in many appointments. But when you're picking a specialist, when you have a child with a very particular disease, sometimes that really isn't enough. Another family, these are... Asian immigrants who didn't know English so well. They had an 11-year-old boy with autism who actually was diagnosed by somebody at church who told them to get him tested because they just thought, oh, well, he's slow at language because they speak Chinese at home and he's a twin. So they never... anyway, one of the issues with them is they never even got an appointment. And Chen says, "It's hard to get in nowhere. I could not get it. Even the doctor tried to help us, the family doctor, tried to help us find one, but it's hard to get in. They didn't even accept a new patient." Now, this was a family on Medicaid, and developmental peds is one of the most difficult appointments to get if you have Medicaid. So most people in Illinois wait about a year for, and if you think about the window of losing treatment in those early years, if you have to wait a year for to get in to the doctor, it's to get a full diagnosis, it's quite difficult. And so most people get by with sort of their early intervention or school diagnoses that are pretty well-rounded, but they don't have the developmental pediatrician point. This one, another limited choice. Just checking. This is a mom of a publicly insured 17-year-old African-American boy with schizophrenia, and she has Medicaid HMO. And she said, "Well, they're pretty good, even though people think it's really bad. But it's pretty good overall. You know, you just have a couple of bad doctors out there. They aren't willing to do their job, and sometimes people need extra support or at least act like you care." So this mom was very aware that there are many doctors who were not great out there, and they were kind of lucky to get a good one. But again, this was, they got who they got. And on the flip side of this spectrum, we had this idea of open choice, that there was something about families that they were able to make a choice, that they had several possibilities, and that there was usually a lot of information and resources involved. So here, this is Isabella. An adoptive mom of a 17-year-old boy with neurofibromatosis. So she says, Yeah, the doctor, we just got him in because he was in the program. It was called this program. I'm not sure if you heard of it, but it was the best. It was the best program in the world. And so this was about, something about this open choice had to do with the best. Like, people wanted the best. They wanted the best doctor, whoever they had heard about, even if a neighbor, a friend, their pediatrician's friend, whoever. It was something about getting the best. And that was about the choice of getting the best. Another, this is Denise, and we were just talking about sickle cell. This is a mom of a 13-year-old African-American girl with sickle cell anemia. And she said, I already was going to the children's hospital, so I actually took her to the children's hospital. And she said, yeah, children's hospital? Yeah, she actually sees Dr. Hematologist, my hematologist. He actually used to be my doctor, and he was, now he's her doctor, and he raised me. So she, her choice was to bring her to the doctor that she knew very, very well, the doctor that treated her. And this was a choice. She could have gone to the one who she got an appointment with, but she used her connections and her emotional connection with this doctor, and knowing how great he was for her in this sort of very subjective way, to feel like she had this choice about getting good care. Just one more quick example. How much time do I have? I'm over. Okay. I'll just finish up. This is another about getting the best doctor. So I'm just going to skip to the end. I was able to see the person fairly quickly because I had a recommendation from another person. So this idea of a referral was a big deal about choice. I'm going to just finish up because I did, I went over. But the last concept that I looked at was the idea of people that were in this limited choice category, that then through resources or some kind of happenstance moved into this open choice category. And this was where you really see the kind of movement and the opening up of services through education, through bumping into people in people's networks, to getting new referrals from doctors, and how people kind of moved from this idea of limited to choice and learning how to advocate for the doctors that they had wanted, or the best doctors, or third, second opinions. So I just want to finish up there. There are more slides. But the reason why I felt like this finding was so important was that it really it changes the way that we think about this dichotomous variable access. Access is really a process. It's not like getting a doctor or not getting a doctor. For some people, access is just getting an appointment. For some people, access is getting the best doctor. And anything other than the best is not access. So when you ask the person who thinks that I have access to care, they only say, well, yeah, I have the head of, pediatric endocrinology at Children's Hospital. So that is access. But for other people, it's just getting in the door and sort of that continuum of care and the continuum of access. So that's sort of what I wanted to end with. And I made a long presentation, but thank you.